It's Wednesday, October the 20th, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linnan. We spend an awful lot of time in this podcast hearing from our own journalists and from others about what dynamics are at play or driving the decisions of those who hold the reins of power. And we do occasionally hear from ministers and others in government about their side of that story, or at least the bits of it which they choose to reveal to us. But we don't often get to hear from those who have actually been involved in the day-to-day strategising, jockeying for power and outright firefighting which goes on behind the scenes at senior ministerial level. All of which means that I am delighted to welcome this week's guest, Ed Brophy. Ed was a special advisor to two different ministers from two different parties in two successive governments. And in 2011, he was hired by Joan Burton when she entered government as Minister for Social Protection in that Fine Gael-Labour coalition. And over the course of that government, of course, Burton became leader of the party and tarnished it. And following the Labour wipeout at the 2016 election, Ed went on to work for Pascal Donoghue, and he remained with the current Minister for Finance until leaving that role earlier this summer. Ed, you're very welcome.
Hi, Hugh. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Pat. I should say Pat is here as well, as always. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning, Hugh.
Ed, I suppose we could go back to that moment in 2011 when you got the job, I suppose. Labour and Fine Gael had just scored a thumping victory in the 2011 general election. Fianna Fáil had been humiliated. The two parties going into government was probably the largest majority in the history of the state. They had more than 55-56% of the vote. What was the mood as that government is being formed and while you got your job?
Yeah, I mean, the mood was a real mix. It was trepidation because I think everyone knew the scale of the task ahead. The state was effectively insolvent and bankrupt. And also, I suppose, excitement and exultation because, you know, it had been a very, very significant victory and, you know, there was an enormous majority. I guess my thoughts going into it were really that perhaps the kind of dangers ahead were underestimated. And I think the reason for that was I had, you know, throughout the campaign become increasingly concerned that the rhetoric of the campaign was that there was a kind of a better way to get out of the, the Troika arrangement or the bailout programme than had been executed by the previous Fianna Fáil government, and that there would be a better way, it would be fairer, and people would, you know, buy into that. And I really didn't really feel any illusions about that. You know, I was never under any particular illusions that that was going to be just enormously difficult, enormously challenging, and create real political danger and damage for the two parties in government. And that's kind of what happened. So
this was Frankfurt's way or Labour's way, I seem to recall.
Frankfurt's way or Labour's way, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And I mean, you know,
turned out to be Frankfurt's way, I think.
It turned out to be a mix. I think it turned out to be a mix of Frankfurt's way and Labour's way. Because had it been Frankfurt's way, for example, the Anglo bond would have continued to be paid of $3.5 billion a year. That was then cancelled by that government, I think, in early 2013. In fact, I remember sitting in the Dáil very late one evening or early one morning and looking at you in the press gallery across the way, Pat, when the Anglo bond was being cancelled by that government. And I remember a subsequent government minister by the name of Mr. Shane Ross objecting in strenuous terms at how outrageous it was that the Dáil was being dragged in to do this perfidious act. But actually, it turned out to be a very good act, and it transformed the public finances. So I don't think it's fair to say it was just Frankfurt's way. I know it also wasn't just Labour's way. But certainly, I think in setting expectations that could really not be met because of the fiscal and, you know, budgetary reality the state confronted, I think the seeds of that government's subsequent destruction were laid very early on.
Was there a sense among Labour in particular, because maybe both parties overpromised, but I think there's not much doubt, as Pat was hinting there, that Labour promised more than Fine Gael did. Were the Labour ministers in the coalition conscious that that was a burden which they were carrying as a result of that 2011 campaign?
Of course they were, yeah. I mean, sure, it hung around them, permanently throughout that government, you know. It's very easy to, in retrospect, say, you know, certain things should have been done differently in campaigns. But I think certainly that the political reality is that that burden definitely hung around Labour to a far greater extent than it hung around Fine Gael. And in many ways, because I suppose Labour's electorate are, you know, the coalition that gave Labour that historical, result expected something different. So, you know, the mismatch between the expectations of the electorate and what could or would be delivered subsequently by that government was an ongoing, political weakness for Labour in that coalition, and less so for Fine Gael, perhaps because their coalition expected different things or were less, sensitised to some of the decisions that government would have to make.
And to what extent then, entering power in the spring, early spring of 2011, to what extent were you constrained? I mean, okay, you make the point there in relation to those bonds, but the reality was that the sort of the parameters for recovery and the programme of austerity had been set, first of all, by Brian Lenihan and the preceding government, and then even more so by the arrival of the Troika and that whole humiliating process which had happened in the 6 months beforehand and the rules which had been set as a result of that.
You mean how constrained were you?
Exactly. How much freedom of manoeuvre did that new government actually feel it had?
I mean, in truth, it had very little freedom of manoeuvre. And remember, you know, very early on in that government, the attempt was made to, you know, gain some freedom by Michael Noonan in cancelling certain bonds. And famously, in retrospect, he was told by the then head of the European Central Bank, Jean-Claude Trichet, that if he were to happen, you know, if that were to happen, a bomb would go off and it wouldn't go off in Frankfurt, go off in Dublin. I think this was really when the minister was on his way into the Dáil to announce that. So any, you know, attempts that were made to free up more space or to get more free of some of the constraints around the Troika were very, very strongly resisted by the Troika at the time. And, you know, that made that government's job much more difficult. I mean, even when it came to the cancellation of the Anglo bond, in reality, you know, no one was really sure what the ECB were going to say. And I think it was only really the fact that Draghi had become the president of the ECB earlier that year in 2012 and then in early 2013. And his response was that he noted the transaction and that was it. And, you know, we knew then that we were kind of free and that we'd made the right decision and that the ECB weren't going to push back on it. But, you know, we never knew that in general before that. And so any attempts to kind of, you know, free yourself from some of the constraints, do things differently, were absolutely, you know, stoutly and vigorously stopped and pushed back on by the Troika, you know. That was the reality we faced. And that's why the kind of experience of this government and the response to the most recent kind of crisis has just been so strikingly different from a European perspective.
I think the government at that time, its first big decision, which I'm not sure was ever an explicit conscious decision it was made, it was something it simply accepted, was to accept the terms and conditions of the bailout. It said it would work to try and change them, but it never seriously considered actually rejecting the terms of the bailout. Is that right?
That's absolutely right, yeah. That's absolutely right. And like, why was that? I mean, it couldn't reject the terms of the bailout. The terms of the bailout had bound the Irish state to an agreement with the Troika, who were the only people who was lending the Irish state money at that time. So, I mean, the clear implication of rejecting that arrangement would have been that
it was a default.
Well, not, yeah, you can call it default, but it would have been
a default and running the risk of crashing out of the euro, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, it would have been default. You know, but I mean, what does that mean? I mean, people say default, but like, what does that mean? It means, you know, in order to pay the salaries of the guards, the nurses, you know, that kind of thing, the Irish state would have got to gone elsewhere to borrow money, and no one else was lending it money. So it would have had to gone to, you know, where could it have gone to get money? I mean, it probably could have gone to some.
It would have had to balance its income and expenditure more or less overnight.
Or that, yeah, which would have been, you know, impossible to do. So, like, again, the constraints that government faced, you know, led it in a particular direction, because all the alternatives were so, you know, appalling and impossible to contemplate. I guess the political problem was that throughout the campaign that preceded it, by, you know, accident or design, our impression that was given by both parties was that you know, there would be a way of doing this in a better, fairer way that would impose less impose less pain on the Irish people. And actually, really, when that government came into office, that just wasn't an option that was available. And yes, we were able to chip away at it at the edges, but not in a way that was meaningful to the electorate.
So what did that mean for you and for your boss at the time, Joan Burton? She's Minister for Social Protection, which at a time of austerity and economic collapse, essentially, in some ways, is a pretty tough gig to have. So presumably what she's doing is trying to fend off some cuts but having to compromise on others, and then to come out with a smile on her face on budget day and say she'd done the best she possibly could. It's a tricky enough and not a particularly pleasant manoeuvre for any politician, is it?
No, and especially one who, you know, was a strong believer in the kind of, you know, social welfare state and in social protection, you know, like Joan was and is. I mean, it was doing the very opposite of what, you know, her political instincts would have been. So it was cutting, you know, welfare schemes, cutting, you know, protection for people, cutting income support for people who, you know, her natural political instinct would be to protect all of those people. So no, it was very, very, very difficult. The difficulty about it, I guess, in a broader sense, was that actually the cuts that we were making at a kind of macro level, you know, with a social welfare budget of about 20 billion, were not enormous. You know, we were cutting maybe 400, 500 million in a number of those austerity budgets. You know, the difficulty was that they affected individuals in very, very, you know, tangible ways. So while at a macro level, we were absolutely protecting the social protection system, and, you know, much of the analysis suggests that Ireland's way of dealing with the bailout and with the Troika, you know, was done in a way that, you know, preserved, you know, income equality to a far greater extent than other countries. It didn't really matter politically because, you know, a reduction in lone parent support, cutting the respite care grant, each single one of these were just enormously politically damaging. And there was no real way to gainsay that. So, I mean, Joan's strategy was always, if there was a number of X indicated for social welfare cuts, you know, in the coming budget, she was going to get it down as much as possible. And she was going to use all her political noose capital and, I guess ultimately just kind of cussedness to push back on that, like, you know, and to say to people, you know, that's too important. I can't do that. So that was it. But that was the kind of, that was the strategy. The strategy was, we knew there were going to be cuts. We knew they were all going to be very damaging. You know, when we started with a blank, sheet of paper every year before the budget, our intention was to just get those cuts down for as much as possible. The problem for the government was, you know, that meant that other ministers would have to face bigger cuts. And there was constantly this kind of standoff between the bigger spending departments. So mainly ourselves and the Department of Health, which was under James Riley at the time, and to a lesser extent, maybe the Department of Education under Rory Quinn. So like it was, you know, even if that strategy worked on its own terms for Joan and for myself and for the Department of Social Protection, at a kind of a government level, it didn't really make the government's job any easier because ultimately the government was going to be faced with, you know, really, really, really difficult kind of, you know, politically uncontemplatable cuts to other programs and other departments. But that was where we found ourselves.
I think at the time, just remembering back to it, Joan Burton's opposition to some of the cuts and the tactics she used within government and in advance of budgets in the media aroused the anger of Fine Gael to an extent that Fine Gael also tried to punish Labour. I mean, I don't think in many of those budgets they gave you a great degree of help. And I always remember the Labour ad, which was terribly effective during the latter stage of the 2011 campaign, based on a Tesco ad. And it was Fine Gael, every little hurts, and it had all these awful things that that Fine Gael were going to do in government, Labour was alleging. And more or less every one of them was subsequently done. Labour had said, vote for us, and we will stop these terrible things from happening. And more or less every one of them was subsequently done in government.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, I don't think in retrospect, the wisdom is always wonderful in politics. That ad kind of, you know, looked particularly good. In terms of Joan's tactics and how that worked with Fine Gael, I mean, you know, Joan brought, I suppose, you know, some political street fighting ability to government in a way that maybe, you know, other people weren't comfortable with, you know, but that was as far as she perceived it, you know, her job, and it was done for political reasons, but it was also done because, you know, her instinct was that we needed to protect social protection. You know, and we needed to do that because if you looked at other countries that had gone through bailout programs, you know, the things that were always hit the most were social protection schemes, which then took years to kind of recover. And it took the people who suffered from those losses years to recover. They were the most vulnerable. So, I mean, it was something she was doing with, you know, the absolutely, you know, best of political convictions. It definitely upset some people. Absolutely. And it affected relations in that government. And relations in that government, despite the fact that people often say that government looked very calm in the exterior, relations were very difficult, often in that government, particularly around budgets. And certainly, you know, some of the kind of approach that Joan and myself adopted may have played into that. But we still felt we were doing the right thing, you know, given the hand we had been dealt.
And were those difficulties, did they play out solely on a Labour Fine Gael axis, or did the one of the other notable things about this period, of course, is the institution, the kind of splitting up of financial responsibilities between two separate ministers, and at that time it would have been Michael Noonan as Minister for Finance and Brendan Howlin as on the public finances area. So was it Labour versus Fine Gael, or was it more complicated than that?
It was more complicated than that, but ultimately Labour always, and Brendan Howlin particularly, always had Jones back ultimately. So yes, there would have been internal tensions within Labour, and yes, you know, some people would have felt that Joan wasn't as much of a team player as she could have been. But ultimately, when it came down to it, when it came down to kind of brass tacks and the nuts and bolts of budgets, you know, Brendan Howlin always ultimately had her back, because his political project is no different to hers. I mean, he's a Social Democrat. I mean, he believed ultimately in the protection, to the extent we could, of social welfare, of the most vulnerable, of incomes for those people, of schemes and support. So, I mean, he was not entering into any of that with any desire to undercut that any further. So, no, I think ultimately it held together. There were tensions, but I think ultimately Labour held together, and Brendan Howlin was very supportive, you know, with every budget we ever did.
But then, of course, it was a complete disaster for them at the 2016 election. Pat, can I just ask you this? Regardless of posters that went up during the 2011 campaign, wasn't Labour essentially signing its own existential warrant by going into this government, and the best that it could possibly do from the Social Democratic perspective was to ameliorate some of the austerity measures which were inevitably going to happen? So it was bound to suffer as a consequence of that decision to go in.
Yes, it absolutely was. But did it have to be as terrible a defeat in 2016 as it turned out to be? Perhaps not. I mean, I think if you go back to that 2011 decision to enter government, I remember actually the Labour convention at which it was decided to enter government. It was held in the O'Reilly Hall in UCD, I think the Sunday after the election. And there really was, I mean, there were a few voices raised in opposition to going in, warning that the Labour Party would be decimated if they entered government, would be Fine Gael's mudguard, etc., etc. But the overwhelming sense of that conference was that, you know, we have asked for a mandate, we've got a substantial vote, we have to go into government. And really, if you think of the counterfactual, what would have been the public facing justification for not going into government? No, we're going to sit in opposition because it is to our political advantage to do so at a time of existential crisis for the country. So I don't think, having fought the campaign that they did...
Well, hold on a sec. Let me give you another counterfactual, and maybe I put this to you, Ed. What if Labour had said, we do not agree with these policies being imposed from Brussels, or wherever they're being imposed from. We did not agree with the policies of the Fianna Fáil government. Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil are closer ideologically. Let them go in and sort out this mess that we did not make.
Yeah, except that presupposes that was on the table, and it wasn't on the table. You know, it definitely wasn't. But I think the other thing that it presupposes is that Labour, you know, felt that by going in, it could improve some of these policies and improve some of the outcomes for the people that it was there to help and there to support and there to protect. So, you know, it was based on a political calculation and a political decision that the alternative was not on the table. You know, the much vaunted Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil coalition of 2011. It just wasn't something that was ever on the table. You know, it's been the subject of some columns, but I've never seen it, you know, as a practical political reality. But the other thing is, I think by going in, Labour, you know, felt that yes, it would face enormous difficulties, and yes, it would disappoint many of the people who had voted for it. And yes, it would not meet their expectations, or the high expectations of some of the media people who at the time were friends of Labour's and subsequently left it behind. But what it could do would be to improve the lives of people by taking control of key departments where it felt it could do things better. And I mean, the record of that government, you know, we can talk about it at length. I think sometimes the record of that government gets kind of obscured by the political, you know, outcome of that government, which was this terrible defeat for Labour and a very bad result for Fine Gael. And people sometimes kind of, you know, don't look back and see, you know, some of the things that government managed to do, which were, you know, very effective. You know, it got Ireland out of the bailout. it presided over a very strong economic recovery, which had jobs at their heart. So it wasn't like a jobless recovery as we'd had before in this country. Managed the bailout program in a way that preserved equality far more than any other country that was in a bailout. And it presided over enormous social change with the marriage equality referendum. So like that government did a lot. Yes, there's a lot it didn't do. And it certainly, disappointed some expectations of people who felt that there was a better, fairer way. But, on balance, and when you do the full accounting, was Labour right to go into that government? I still think it absolutely was, because I think it was able to do, good things for the people and positive things for the people who voted for it. And whether that was, the political reckoning at the end or not, is another question. But in terms of substantively what that government did, I think that government, did a lot of good.
There's a reality as well, Pat. Can I ask you, just in relation to that, there's a reality as well, which is that this thing is sometimes mischaracterized as politicians grubbily wanting to get their hands on the lever of power. But politicians, or most politicians, do want to get into power to pursue the policies which they spent their lives arguing for. And that's very legitimate. And particularly when a party like Labour had been out of power for a decade and a half at that point, it's quite understandable that the politicians of the generation of Brendan Howell and John Burton and Rory Quinn wanted to get back into government, because that's what, as far as they were concerned, that's what politics was for.
Well, a politician who doesn't want to get into government is of very limited utility. I won't say they're completely useless, but their utility to the public is I think severely limited. I think the strategic mistake that both parties made was in remaining in government after the exit from the bailout, after the the fiscal independence to some degree had been regained, after a recovery had been put in place. I think they should have at that stage gone to the electorate and said, "We have done what we can. We need a fresh." We need a fresh mandate for the future. And before you accuse me of hindsight, I think I wrote pretty similar stuff at the time, because I think what happened that government, after it took a bit of a shellacking in the 2014 local and European elections, it was obviously a change of leadership in the Labour Party. Eamon Gilmore resigned, Joan Burton became leader, Ed moved into swanky new offices in government buildings.
Hardly.
I think that at that stage, the government struggled to articulate a purpose, to define any forward momentum. In fact, it went into reverse, really, abandoning its plan to introduce water charges for understandable reasons. And from then, from late 14 until early 16, the government was constantly on the back foot. So, we can never know, but I think if the government had gone for a general election, either in 2013 after the exit from the bailout, in 2014, or even in 2015, I don't think that the result would necessarily have been as bad for Labour as it turned out to be.
To just push back a little bit on that counterfactual pass, the actual, lived experiment of the 2014 local and European elections would suggest otherwise. I mean, both government parties did very, very badly in those elections. And I just think, if you're suggesting that they should have had a general election at that stage as well, I'm just not sure if that would have gone particularly well. Where I do agree with you is that the government lost its initiative after we left the bailout. Like, definitely it lost its momentum because, and you know this, having watched governments over the years, all governments have to have a sense of purpose, have a sense of momentum. And like, the big sense of purpose of that government was get us out of the bailout, get the economic recovery going, get people back to work. That was it. And actually there was a complete sense of purpose and a coherence actually across all the parties on that. Like, the two parties worked pretty well on all that. That kind of atrophied and then just kind of, disappeared really after we got out of the bailout. And the period after the bailout from, early 2014 until mid 2016 was just one rolling political difficulty after another. Like, the Garda stuff, the water charges you've alluded to, and just various other things. And the government really was never able to get, its initiative back, despite the fact that actually the external picture was really good. I mean, the economic recovery was really strong. People were going back to work. The mood of the country, I think, probably lifted. But the government didn't get any political bounce from that. And, the rest is history.
So the 2016 election happens and Labour, as you said, is as good as wiped out, essentially. It's a really shocking result, a disastrous result for the party. You're out of a job. But then you get offered a job by the other crowd. Because that happened, I do wonder about that. How strong are the party affiliations of the advisor teams around different ministers? I mean, does that kind of travelling from one party to another happen much?
Well, I mean, it kind of depends. I mean, some people are obviously very involved with parties beforehand and then they get jobs, and some people are brought in because they have other career experience. And I would probably have fallen into the latter camp, when I came into work for Jones. So I'd obviously done some stuff for the Labour Party, but I was never, a Labour member or anything like that. So I was brought in because I had different career experience that she was looking for and different skills. So that's one thing. And then the other thing as well is, I always do find it somewhat curious that there is criticism about someone who worked for, one party going to work for another party in circumstances where both parties were in coalition. I mean, they were able to be politically close enough to have a coalition agreement with each other and, be in government with each other for 5 years. So I didn't particularly think, there was anything particularly, strange or controversial about that. And also, I think, the person I went to work for, Pascal Donoghue, Brendan Howland is very famously on record as saying, if the Labour Party was kind of a Labour Party like it is in the UK, a big kind of mass party, Pascal Donoghue would probably be in the Labour Party, I mean, he is on the, he wouldn't describe himself as a social democrat, but he's not really that different in many of his positions from the Labour Party. So I didn't feel it was an issue, and I also felt that there was considerable amount of unfinished business. So that government ended badly. It was a considerable amount of unfinished business, and I felt that working with Pascal Donoghue was maybe a way of kind of, working through some of those issues, those policies that the previous government hadn't managed to kind of close off or finish. And that was my experience. I was able to do that.
So Pascal Donoghue, if he is, as you say, kind of on the more social democratic wing of Fine Gael, he was a rising star, and then ultimately he replaced Michael Noonan, who I wouldn't characterise as being on the social democratic wing of Fine Gael. I think that's right to say. Does that represent a shift within Fine Gael then?
Well, I mean, Fine Gael changed. I mean, Fine Gael changed very significantly, both towards the end of the Kenny government and then with the arrival of Leo Varadkar as leader in Taoiseach. I mean, I remember a Fine Gael advisor, one of Kenny's main people, telling me that, if at the beginning of the government in 2011, Enda Kenny had been told that he would, legislate for the X case, and bring in marriage equality, people would have in white coats would have taken them out of the office. They were quite conservative on those issues at the start of 2011. And they'd gone, on a journey, to use that cliche, during that government, both in economic policy, but also on the kind of liberal agenda. And I guess when Leo Varadkar became leader of Fine Gael and Taoiseach, that was kind of copper fastened. So it became, a much more socially liberal party than it had previously been. And it maybe harked back to the social liberalism of the Fitzgerald era in the 80s. So that's on the social liberal side. On the economic policy side, maybe less so. I mean, I think Leo Varadkar's economic disposition is a classic liberal. He's a classic, classic kind of believer in enterprise, in competitive tax, that kind of thing. Pascal would be slightly different. He would have a slightly different view. He'd be more a believer in the mixed economy, that the state and the market are key constituent parts of the economy, and we need to support both. We can't just, have an economy that's based entirely on the free market. We need the state as a key actor in the economy and a key driver of, economic change and economic progress. So slightly different views there. But I think in terms of, the social agenda, yes, Fine Gael became a much more liberal party and is a much more, socially liberal party than it had been previously.
Pascal Donoghue is also the Minister for Finance, who's just produced a budget that had, in its, discretionary changes on budget day, had 9 parts increases in public spending to 1 part tax cuts. So, I mean, I think Fine Gael has moved. I'm not sure what you call a budget that does that, but most people, in other countries would refer to that as a social democratic budget.
Yeah, and look, one of the great kind of geniuses of the kind of two large parties in Irish political life, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, has been their ability to pivot when the centre of politics, moved, and to kind of align themselves to that new centre, to that new kind of settlement in Irish politics, whatever it is. To the extent that new centre is now social democratic on economic policy, they have realigned themselves to that. And, I suppose what I'm saying about Pascal Donoghue is he probably, was maybe ahead of the game on that. I think that is his natural conviction anyway. So I think where Fine Gael is at on economic policy now is consistent with where he's always been. It's just the rest of the party has probably been on a journey to that place as well. And it's taken it a while, but that's where it is. And you're absolutely right. But Irish budgets now are predominantly about spending, and they're really not very much about tax at all.
Pat, I mean, you have written more than once, I think, about the political journey of Leo Varadkar, and in particular, the way in which he has moved on, or appears to have moved on economic matters in particular, while retaining the social liberalism. He seems less keen on the people who get up in the morning thing now than he was a few years ago.
Well, as we know, he missed a Morning Ireland interview last week because he didn't get up early in the morning. So perhaps this is an aspect of his lived experience playing into his politics. But not to be flippant about it, I think there's something about government that tends to convince politicians of the utility of government and the ability of government to make changes in people's lives. And that invariably leads them, to a position where they're more interested in public spending than in tax cuts. Now, I think there is a danger with Leo Varadkar, and I wrote about this again recently, where, he is... he wants to have his cake and eat it a little bit, where he is, talking about tax cuts, but he's also talking about taxpayer funded one-off giveaways in some respects, but also in embedding long-term public spending increases into the health service. It was Leo Varadkar who first argued that the health service should retain all of the extra 4 billion it got last year, half of which was to deal with COVID. So these are very much not the sort of things one expects to hear from a fiscal conservative, which I think Leo would probably admit himself is where he was 10 years ago. But, I think I've said it on this podcast recently that Brendan Howland used to joke only half in jest, I think, that, Labour's greatest achievement in government between 2011 and 2016 was to make a Social Democrat out of Leo Varadkar. Mr. Varadkar might dispute that tag, but it is certainly true that many of the policies that he espouses fit under it now.
But it is true also, isn't it, Ed, that larger forces are at work here?
Yeah.
I think you've been writing a little bit about this yourself over the last while, which is that particularly in the wake of COVID, but actually before that, with the rise of new forms of populism of left and right, there's been a repositioning of financial orthodoxy among economists and economic thinkers, as well as among politicians, in terms of what the ambit of the state is, how much resources it can draw on, and generally more towards a more interventionist state and what's called, I think, modern monetary theory.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is something we see everywhere. I mean, even the former president of the United States, Mr. Trump. When you get behind all the kind of the anti-democratic stuff and the kind of strange way of conducting himself, if you look at his policy program, what he sold to people, it was not a Republican policy program at all. Now, he governed as a classic Republican. He was governed as a classic tax cutting Republican, because that's the way Congress directed him. But, his whole program was about, keep on paying Medicare, keep on paying entitlements, big infrastructure investment. It was definitely not a small state Republican agenda. We see it with Mr. Johnson in the UK as well, who, has never seen a spending proposal that he doesn't like, and actually always has another one to offer as well. That is certainly the way. I think the danger about this is both economic and political, though, and I've written a bit about the economics. I mean, that's all fine. I mean, I am very much a believer in a strong state, an effective state, maybe more than like the size of the state. I just think we get a little bit obsessed about the size of the state and we don't talk about the effectiveness of the state, and the size of the state argument means we don't spend enough time looking at what the state actually does and what we want it to do. So that's something I believe in. But you got to pay for it, over the economic cycle, over the cycle, you got to pay for it. You cannot fund a permanently bigger state by issuing bonds that are bought by investors. You just can't do that. You can do that for infrastructure, you can do that for capital spending, and you can have a kind of a golden rule where you borrow only to invest over the economic cycle. Gordon Brown famously did that in the 2000s, and it was very successful. But you can't, pay nurses' salaries, guard salaries, that kind of thing, teacher salaries, by borrowing in the bond markets. You can't do that, and so we will have to stop doing that. I think probably what's happened is, because most of the bonds are being bought by central banks, there's kind of a circularity about it now. So the state is selling its own debt to its own central banks. So therefore, some politicians perceive there to be no real budget constraint at all. And in a way, the government has been operating without a budget constraint for the last 18 months. So I think the recent budget was kind of important in that regard. I think despite the fact that there was quite a lot of spending, I think Pascal Donoghue and Michael McGrath, you know, very much indicated that there was going to have to be a spending rule. You know, spending can only grow at a certain rate and that they would only be borrowing to invest from, I think, next year onwards. And look, I hope that they're successful in that. And I think it's important for the credibility of the government and the state that that happens. But otherwise, I think, yeah, you get into a situation where, you know, no project is not liked and spending is just considered to be just, you know, something that doesn't get queried or interrogated. I think the political difficulty is something that probably hasn't been talked about enough. And I think it's very real. If you look at the likes of Mr. Trump, Mr. Johnson, Mr. Orban, people like that, what they're promising really is, you know, a bigger state. So kind of social democratic economics with kind of right wing authoritarian politics, you know, and, you know, I wouldn't kind of too heavily draw the political analog here with, you know, what we've seen before in the 20th century when that plays out. But I mean, it can be quite disturbing, you know, so, it is a concern and it's very much, you know, predicated on an anti-immigrant politics. So it's like, you know, we will spend a lot more. We will give it to you, the true people of America, Britain or Hungary or whoever it is. And we won't let the foreigners have any of it. And we will kind of, you know, align it with this populist authoritarian politics that, you know, delivers us, you know, political power over a long period of time. I think that's where it's dangerous politically. I don't perceive that danger in Ireland particularly, but I do think there is that edge to this, you know, increase in the frontiers of the state that we see in other countries that probably hasn't probably been properly litigated. And I think it's something we do need to be very careful about.
Why do you think we don't see it in Ireland?
We don't see it in Ireland because the parties in power do not pursue that kind of politics. And the main opposition party has not pursued an anti-immigration politics, despite the fact that maybe 20% of its electorate would like it to do that. So that hasn't happened yet. But, you know, there are no ultimate limits to the way politics plays out. So I don't think we should be complacent about that. But we certainly haven't seen it yet. And in fairness to Sinn Féin, you know, they could have played the anti-immigrant card and they could have played that kind of, you know, big state authoritarianism card much more. The fact that they haven't to date is certainly to their credit. And it's one of the things I would credit them for.
Pat, can I ask you something about Pascal Donoghue then? Because one of the interesting things about the budget was that sort of last minute shimmy around how much money was actually available and perhaps even a bit of kind of clever card playing on the part of Michael McGrath and Pascal Donoghue. And it turned out that they actually had a little bit more money, but they didn't tell anybody about it, which says something, doesn't it? As much as anything, it sends a signal about their priorities and their political sensibilities.
Yeah, less a last-minute shimmy than kind of a last-minute anti-shimmy. It was the lack of the shimmy, I think, not to get too technical about it, was the instructive thing. So, you know, let us recap what happened. That in July, with a summer economic statement, the government adjusted its long-term fiscal parameters and said that it would borrow more over the period of this government, but it would move to period over the next 2 years, where, as Ed says, it would reduce or eliminate borrowing for current expenditure, borrow substantially and above the European average for investment purposes to answer the needs in infrastructure, particularly in housing and so forth. And in doing that, it set a budget day ceiling of 4.7 billion euros, which is a very big budget by the standards of what would be typical in recent years, with the exception, obviously, of last year's COVID budget, where, you know, 20 billion was borrowed to meet the costs of COVID in all their manifestations. Now, between July and, you know, D-Day for the budget in early October, the state's fiscal position improved dramatically in that there was a much quicker economic rebound than had been anticipated and taxes still flowing into the exchequer's coffers. Now, what we would have expected to happen there. And what certainly I think would have happened in previous years, again, last year expected, is that there would have been a jump on budget day. Ed will be no stranger in the past to finding a couple of hundred million euros or a billion euros down the back of the couch in the Department of Finance on budget day to solve all sorts of political problems. And then the budget day ceiling would rise. And I, for one, expected it to rise at least above 5 billion and possibly beyond that. But it didn't. Now, exactly what happened behind the scenes, I don't yet know. But I'm pretty sure that there was an effort made by not just spending departments, but, you know, perhaps by the centre of government, by the party leaders, to ease the political pressure on them by increasing spending beyond the 4.7 billion euros on budget day. And despite the fact that they had the resources at their disposal to do that, Pascal Donoghue and Michael McGrath didn't do it. And I think that tells us a couple of important things about the balance of power within government, about their partnership, which it seems to me is the most important axis within the coalition government, but also about the the caution that as long as they are in charge of it, will mark the state's fiscal behaviour and spending plans. And I think that is an important development. And I think it's gone somewhat under the radar in the reaction to the budget.
I mean, Pat's point there, Ed, about the axis between the two ministries of finance and public expenditure and reform. As I mentioned earlier, the same axis existed in the 2011-2016 government, and then it was done away with for a while, and now it's back again.
Yeah.
And it does really reinforce the primacy of essentially the Department of Finance in manifested these two departments now within government, particularly when significant heavyweights from the two main parties in government occupy those positions and establish a good working relationship, which also happened with Howland and Noonan, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, it does. I mean, the alternative is that you would just have a single Department of Finance, and people would say that it was too overmighty and too powerful as well. But I mean, in dividing them into two departments, some of that power is maintained. And you know, my experience is that it probably makes sense to do it like that. I mean, you probably need to do it in a coalition like we have at the moment, where you know both parties will want to have one of those departments. It didn't happen in the confidence and supply period, which was, I suppose, strange because, you know, it was effectively a Fine Gael single-party government with Pascal Donoghue for most of that period as Minister for Finance and Public Expenditure. And that was a very, very big ask for anyone. I mean, it is an enormous job. So I think it's better administratively and it's better politically if you have the two departments. They would say that... you know, Pat's right. There was no move on budget day, and that does tell you something, and it tells you something about them asserting their power and about the functional relationship between the two ministers, withstanding calls from other departments for increases, given how much more money was available. But the departments would say that spending is at an extraordinarily high level, and the extraordinarily high level of spending has been locked in from the pandemic. So in their world, what the state is now doing budget wise. Is that a kind of it's a level shift beyond where it was before the pandemic, and an awful lot that has been locked in. The state will spend, I think, 95 billion in 2025. It was spending 70 billion in 2020 at the height of the pandemic. So, in anyone's language, that is an enormous expansion in the scale of the spending into state and the state's role in the economy. So that's the way they would see it. And they would see, the questions that we should be asking is, the questions that I was asking before, is that effective? What should the state be doing? What do we want the state to be doing? How do we fund it? Do we borrow? Do we tax? Do we invest? So they're the questions they would be asking. And I think they're the pertinent questions. And I think the fact that, you have a very strong relationship at the centre of Merrion Street between the two ministers and the two departments, with new secretary generals, hopefully in a position to assert himself. I think it's critical. I mean, some people complain about the dead hand of finance and the treasury view and that kind of thing. But you just do need that in a government, because otherwise, lots of bad things can happen. And, it's when the bad things happen that the fingers get pointed after the event, as we, discovered in this country about a decade ago and we've discovered previously. So I think having a strong institutional political presence of those two departments is absolutely critical to the success of any government. And it would be exactly the same under a Sinn Féin government, under a Sinn Féin-led government. And remember, it would be a Sinn Féin-led government. They would be in government with other parties, so they wouldn't have complete freedom of action. You know, there would be, you know, two ministers in Merrion Street. One of them would be Piers Doherty, probably in finance, and there would be a public spending minister from another party working with him. And exactly the same institutional factors would apply, and exactly the same political pressures would be applied to them. So I think that is an ever-present, but I think it's absolutely necessary as well.
I find it interesting that public expenditure and reform, the reform just seemed to have dropped off like some kind of amputated limb. At some point, everybody just refers to it as public expenditure now. But I did want to ask you, the time clock is ticking a little bit. I want to ask you just another question about Pascal Donoghue, with whom you worked for for quite a long time. And he does seem to me to be a person of who caution is part of his makeup and is probably what you might want from somebody in his particular job. I mean, in your experience, particularly in your last year in the job there, when the pandemic overturned all the usual expectations, I look at financial projections and predictions. They seem to me that you could be entered for the Booker Prize for fiction a lot of the time in terms of the way they actually turn out in the end. But maybe more now than for a very long time, it's really difficult to know what the future holds. You know, we're in this entering this post-pandemic period. Some people say that this inflation that we're seeing is a temporary blip. Some people say it's a long-term trend. Some people welcome it. Some people see it as a huge danger. More locally, we have specific questions about the future of corporation tax and what impact that might have on the economy, and a range of other things. There's a lot to be said for caution right now, isn't there? And is there a lot of caution about the unknowability of what lies ahead within government at the moment?
So I think it's caution, but I think it needs to be caution tempered with vision and ambition. So I think you're right. Caution is right, because it is a very, very uncertain world out there. And the world is probably moving to a new kind of global economy after the pandemic, where, you know, things like supply chains, inflation, things like that become much more important. And then obviously, you know, climate change kind of overhangs everything and feeds into financial stability and into, you know, other dimensions of risk as well. So I think, yeah, absolutely caution, but there needs to be a bit of vision applied to it as well. Because, you know, the state's economy really is successful because it's able to import capital and import foreign direct investment. And, you know, it was so important to get the OECD agreement right in that regard, because that then feeds into the long term vision for the economy. So, I mean, I think caution would be the watchword. But I think if you look at what the Department of Finance and Public Expenditure need to do in the coming years, they kind of need to not quite reinvent the economy, but they need to put the economy onto a new kind of footing for a kind of a post pandemic world and a post kind of first stage of globalization world, where globalization will not go away, but it will change. And it may be much less about the kind of globalization that we've seen before, about, you know, manufacturing stuff in different places and, you know, moving stuff offshore to capture, you know, cost gains or tax gains or things like that. It just may be a different form of globalization. So they need to be, you know, flexible, aware of that. And then also they need to manage the challenges that the state faces, particularly around housing, and make sure that gets delivered and gets delivered in a cost-effective way. Because with all this money sloshing around the system and with this kind of, you know, big 10-year investment plan that they have, the National Development Plan, it's really, really important that money is used well and doesn't, you know, end up purely kind of, you know, improving the bottom lines of construction companies and various advisors and, you know, people who will be getting their cut. It's really, really important that the state delivers that in a way that produces housing and produces infrastructure in a cost-effective way. And, you know, the experience in the past has been that the state has been great at doing that, so it really needs to up its game there. So I think it's caution, but I do think it's also vision, and I do think it's also ambition. But I think an awful lot will proceed from what happens in Merrion Street between those two ministers.
And a last question to you, Pat. How well equipped do you think the Irish administrative state, both elected and permanent and temporary advisers, is to deliver that vision with caution, which Ed describes there?
I'm not sure how well it is, to be honest, because I think our politics tends to be, you know, increasingly short term. We're going, you know, we are, I think the structures of our politics are changing. Some of that is, you know, entirely obvious. As in, you know, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are now basically on the one side in government. They haven't worked out how to be political rivals or electoral rivals and governmental allies yet. So they'll have to do that. Does that end up with one of them being, you know, always the senior partner, one of them being the junior partner? I'm not sure. But on the other side of the aisle, and I was remarking on it last week in the budget coverage, is something that is, you know, the other side of the Dáil chamber is no longer offering basically the same package, just done more efficiently, or so they say. It's offering something quite different, or they say they are offering something quite different. So our politics is becoming more hyper competitive. As to whether that is conducive to a government that is subsequently more effective, frankly, I have my doubts about that. And I think that's one of the reasons why the importance of the institutions, and we talked about, you know, the role of the Department of Finance, Department of Public Expenditure there. I think that role and that of independent agencies who scrutinise the government, the role of people like the CNAG, the role of Dáil committees to interrogate spending projects and spending priorities, I think those sort of things will become more important.
We shall leave it there. Thanks very much indeed to Ed for joining us for this chat today. Thanks also to Pat for joining us. And thank you to our producer, Jennifer Ryan, and to Declan Conlon also. We're going to be back very soon. Do remember you can mail us with your thoughts and your questions at politicspodcast@irishtimes.com. Thanks very much indeed for listening. The Irish Times Inside Politics podcast is taken to the road this year with a series of podcasts in front of live audiences. The first is on April the 10th in the Mac in Belfast, when we're going to be discussing the impact of the year of elections on politics across the island of Ireland. We would love to see you there and hear what you have to say too. So to book, go to events.irishtimes.com. That's events.irishtimes.com.